Hello, and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. My guests this week are National Ambassador for Children's Literature, Walter Dean Myers, whose new book is All the Right Stuff, and historian Arthe Anthony, who is the author of Picturing Black New Orleans, a Creole photographer's view of the early 20th century. It's such an honor to welcome Walter Dean Myers to The Reading Life. He's the National Ambassador for Children's Literature, only the third to hold that post from the Library of Congress, and he's coming to the Louisiana Book Festival in Baton Rouge on October 27th. He's won virtually every award you can win for children's literature, 2 Newbery Awards, 5 Coretta Scott King Awards, the first Michael Prince Award, the list goes on. His novels and picture books illuminate and celebrate the African-American experience, and he is beloved among young readers for understanding their lives and speaking their truths. We're talking to Walter Dean Myers today from London. Welcome to The Reading Life, Walter.
Well, thank you. I'm very pleased to be with you.
You're well into your first year of this post. What have been some of the highlights for you?
Well, it's been a busy year to begin with. What I want to do is to spread the word that literacy is not something that is optional. We need, from a national point of view and from the point of view from the communities and families, to make all of our children readers. You know, I'm supported by the Every Child a Reader Foundation and the Children's Book Council. And what we want to do is to make every child in America literate. And right now, we're not doing a great job of that. We're sort of suggesting that reading is nice and reading is fun, but we're not saying that it's vital to everyone's life. And it is. You know, it's made a difference in my life. My life has been changed by reading and by books tremendously. I mean, I could have been, you know, a person with a very different life, a very poor life, but it hasn't been.
And you began reading really as a child with your mother, right?
She read, and she read to me. That made a huge difference to me, not so much because she was teaching me something, but because I enjoyed the time with her. You know, she's a mama. By the time I was 5, I could read, yes.
I'm always curious to ask writers this. Who was the first person you think who showed you that it was possible to become a writer? You know, for some people, it's very hard to imagine that without the concrete example before them. Who would that have been for you?
But I had a teacher that said to me, just before I dropped out of high school, Walter, she said, whatever you do, continue writing. That's what you do. And I went back to that as a young man, and she was right. That's what I do.
That is a great gift when somebody shows you that way.
Yes. Huh?
Now, I just know you know something about New Orleans. You've written so much about jazz and the blues, and you seem to have a special feeling for this place.
Well, actually, my first trip to Louisiana was not to New Orleans, but was to Shreveport and around the Red River. And I went to many, many towns as a young soldier. And I also played basketball all over Louisiana. Then, of course, I found New Orleans later in life, and I loved New Orleans. But, I liked Louisiana.
You've also done some really beautiful and important books with your son, the artist Christopher Myers. Tell us what it's like to work with him, to have that kind of family affair going with books.
It's difficult. It's hard, you know, because the father-son thing, you can never escape that. You know, I'm very pleased with Christopher. I think he's developing his talents just the way I would want him to. But you always have that father-son thing. You always want to tell him, Christopher, I'm your father. Do what I tell you to. And he wants to go his own way. And that's good. You know, what you want your children to grow up and be their own person. And he certainly is.
Well, he always looks pretty happy to be with you and be working with you, I have to say. One of the fascinating things about your work to me is that you deal with the toughest realities of young lives today. You know, the ever-present drugs, the fear of violence in schools and on the streets, fractured families, missing fathers, struggling mothers and grandmothers, and yet so many of these young characters persevere and go on. And I know some people have been critical of what they call grim young adult literature. What do you have to say about that?
The reality is that there are 2 million children who live at or below the poverty level. And the broken families and the violence is an everyday part of their lives. So I really feel that I'm writing for these young people.
I know
the books transmit values. And so what I have to do is to bring their lives into books to give them value. I know that there are some people who criticize this, but you cannot simply ignore these people. You cannot ignore these children.
One of the things I'd like to talk to you about before we close is your new book, All the Right Stuff. This is the loveliest book. It is so philosophical. It's a philosophical debate, basically, about the social contract told through varying viewpoints. I wonder if you'd describe a little bit about this book and how it came to you.
As I speak to young people, I see that many of them don't have the kind of around-the-dinner-table conversations that previous generations enjoyed. What they need is fundamental arguments and fundamental discussions of what their lives are about and what is going to influence those lives. So what I wanted to do was to get a fundamental concept with which I can teach young people and with which I can at least begin having them thinking about some of the things which will affect their lives. And the social contract, of course, is there. And many young people are not aware of this. But I hope that I can bring them to that awareness and bring them to the idea of at least thinking there's more to their lives than their everyday existence.
Well, it was fascinating to read because it is such a long and philosophical and very respectful discussion between this young student, Paul, and his mentor, Elijah, in a soup kitchen for seniors. And it's, you know, when Paul shows up for his summer work, it's clear he's going to learn so much more than merely soup making. And yet, you know, it's suspenseful. It's beautiful. You can't quite forget it when you've finished it. And I think it leaves people with such a strong sense of how to think about community, self-interest, responsibility to others. It's one of the most beautiful books I've read recently at all.
Oh, thank you. I really appreciate that.
Well, you can meet Walter Dean Myers at the Louisiana Book Festival October 27th. He'll be speaking in the Senate Chamber of the Capitol Building from 1 to 1:45, discussing Reading is Not Optional, a conversation with the Ambassador for Young People's Literature. It's been such a privilege to talk with you, Walter. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Artha Anthony teaches American Studies at Occidental College in Los Angeles. Her new book is Picturing Black New Orleans, a Creole photographer's view of the early 20th century. It is the study of the work of her maternal great-aunt, Florestine Perrault Collins, who had a remarkable career photographing the people of New Orleans. Hi, Artha. Welcome to The Reading Life.
Thank you.
Florestine Perrault Collins lived from 1898 to 1985. She saw a lot of change in her life, and she made a lot of changes in her life. Tell us what it was like growing up with her and your family.
Well, she retired to Los Angeles in 1949, so I knew her as my great aunt. She had stopped working as a professional photographer. So the way I knew her was as someone who taught me knitting and who would wrap my knuckles with the needle when I dropped a stitch. She never really learned how to cook, so one of her favorite meals was to boil small pork chops. She was fiercely independent. She painted her house in her 60s. I knew her as very creative. She had a kiln in her garage. She took classes at the local high school, night school, learned how to upholster furniture, make hats, paint ceramics. So she was very creative, even though she did not continue to work as a professional photographer. Although she did take occasional photographs, such as the one she took of me that's in the book of my first communion picture.
That's truly a beautiful photograph, I think. And later, you know, while she was in Los Angeles, she was truly the matriarch of your family, wasn't she?
Very much so. I was interested in oral history because I knew I wanted to study the Creole community in New Orleans between 1880 and 1920 for my dissertation. And I knew I would have to rely on oral histories in order to do that. So I had been advised to interview the oldest member of my family. So I went to her, and I did everything wrong. You're supposed to do a pre-interview, which I did not do. So when I went to interview her, I asked closed-ended questions instead of open-ended questions. I made a lot of assumptions about her career as a photographer, about which I knew very little. And I had assumed that her younger brother, Arthur, my grandfather, had taught her photography. And she made it very clear to me that it was the other way around. And at the time, her recollections were of opening her studio in 1935 in the major black business district on South Rampart Street. So that's what we talked about. And then later she showed me her photograph album. This is before she returned to New Orleans at age 80. And I was fascinated by the pictures because I didn't know the people in them. And she pointed them out, my great-grandmother, my great-great-grandmother, and other members of the family. So I was intrigued by them. Then I visited her in New Orleans a couple of years later, and she had completely rearranged the photograph album to show the relationship between people so that she had pictures of one of her sisters, for example, with photos of her sister with her daughter and grandchildren clustered together. So my original thought was to consider the photograph albums as a form of visual autobiography, and I didn't get anywhere with that. So it took quite a long time for me to realize that the most compelling story was of her as the photographer who had taken those pictures. And then I started tracking down her history because something told me she started as a photographer long before 1935.
She seemed to think of herself as a businesswoman as much as an artist, right?
She did not think of herself as an artist. She thought of herself strictly as a businesswoman.
And she sought to become integrated with the community at all kinds of levels. She was doing church photographs. She was doing wedding photographs. I mean, I love the way she captures so many lovely moments in people's lives. I think of that photograph of Baby Briscoe on the cover. And
yes,
it's such a charming photograph. I wonder if you'd describe it for us.
Well, it is of Melissa Baby Briscoe in a tuxedo with a white jacket, holding a baton with a black bow tie. And she had performed in New York. She was from New Orleans, and she returned to perform in New Orleans. And she did not lead an orchestra. The baton was a prop, and it was taken in the mid-1930s.
Well, she looks very sassy, I must say. She looks like she could lead an orchestra.
And Forstein photographed other entertainers. One was of Elmo the Fan Dancer that I found in Louisiana Weekly, but it was not of a quality to reproduce for the book. And there's another photo in the book of Mae Diggs, who had starred in films, and she returned home and was photographed at Collins' studio.
And it's so amazing to see Andrew Young's baby pictures. He's the former mayor of Atlanta, the former ambassador to the United Nations. Just amazing. And here he is in the All Together and dressed as a cowboy for Mardi Gras.
Well, I spoke with Andrew at great length about a week and a half ago, and he loves the book. And I'd gotten permission from him to use a photo of him as a baby. And so he joked about it.
Well, it was adorable, as most baby photos are. But one of the things I love about these photographs is that every one of the subjects looks so spirited. They all look like they're having fun. And it makes me imagine what kind of person she was, that she was able to coax that out of the people who were sitting for her.
Well, yes. I mean, she made her photographs very much in cooperation with the subject.
Do you remember when she photographed you at that moment?
I do, because it was a very important moment in my life to make my first communion.
And what did she do?
Well, as I said, first communion was a very special moment, and it was, you know, very important for her to capture that moment in her living room.
I'm curious to know, because you interviewed her over a good period of time, and she's part of your family, but I'm curious to know, in the course of the research, what you learned about her that surprised you the most.
What was interesting is that I only interviewed her once, and I learned very little about her career. The person who gave me the most information about her life was her dear friend, Jeanette Warburg Altman, who had almost a photographic memory. And she had lived with Forstein when she was first married to Eilert Bertrand. So she recalled many details of Forstein's early life. So I relied on her a great deal.
And she also was one of her models.
Yes.
That she practiced with, practiced her photography skills on.
She was a practice model. And she happened to keep a lot of those photos from the 1920s. So she recalled a great deal about Forstein's early life. And I was surprised by Forstein's independence and her entrepreneurship.
Well, one of the things I love so much about your book is the introduction, the very first chapter where you say, to land her first job in Jim Crow New Orleans, she passed for white. As a single female teenager in the first decade of the 20th century, she moved out of her parents' home. After a decade of marriage to a jealous ice man whose insecurities were exacerbated by her independence, she got a divorce. Her Creole culture may have circumscribed women's roles, but Florestine Marguerite Perrault, intentionally or not, was often pushing at the edges. And I love the way you stress how she focused her energies on the genteel dimensions of life.
Well, yes, because this is in stark contrast to the pervasive caricatures of African Americans that were throughout white American culture. The caricatures were hideous. So this is in sharp contrast to those.
And these are
pretty much in the spirit of the Harlem Renaissance, which I've learned from teaching a course on the Harlem Renaissance, was not simply based in Harlem. So her photographs in the 1920s reflect the emphasis on dignity, respectability, full citizenship rights. So she's in that spirit of the 1920s.
Oh, very much. And so many of the people are dressed as flappers. It's really lovely to see those photos. I'm curious to know, because you grew up in Los Angeles, right?
Yeah.
So what drew you to New Orleans as a topic of research?
I was curious when I was a graduate student because my parents were part of the post-World War II migrants who came to Los Angeles. So there's a very large Creole community here. And I grew up thinking of myself as a Black American. But I was very keenly aware of my parents' world and that it was a Creole world. And I was just trying to sort out what that meant. So in pursuit of that, I did my dissertation on the Creole community in New Orleans between 1880 and 1920, using oral history, trying to define the Creole community. So that's what drew me to the subject. And in fact, for the book, I rely on many of those interviews I conducted of people who were born at the turn of the 20th century to provide context for Florestine's life, because I had very little information to go on because my interview with her was threadbare.
Well, I just love the way you've brought her to life in this book, and I think that people are going to love it. You can meet Arthe Anthony when she signs Picturing Black New Orleans, A Creole Photographer's View of the Early 20th Century at Garden District Bookshop Thursday, October 25th at 5:30, Saturday, October 27th at the Louisiana Book Festival in Baton Rouge, and Sunday, October 28th from 1 to 3 p.m. at Octavia Books, and later, October 28th from 4 to 6 at the Museum of Free People of Color on Esplanade. Thank you so much, Arthe.
Well, thank you for your time and for interviewing.
Ah, Creole gal, how you love your bacchanal. Ah, you see them Creole gal, boy, they love their bacchanal. I mean, they move their hips in a funny way, dance all night and sleep all day. Then they start a polishing, lordy lord, how they love romancing. When you see them on the street, they got rhythm in their feet. Yes, they are born Creole, got their rhythm in their soul. When they move their hips in a funny way, dance all night and sleep all day. Then they start a polishing, lordy lord, how they love romancing. Ba 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 di lo de do. We all can dance, I can do bambete, I can fed it to now, on the league to a baila. When she move them hips in a funny way, dance all night and sleep all day. Then she start a polishing, lordy lord, how she love romancing.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Tanya Coop Marking and Jennifer Snape celebrate their new book of historical photos, Louisiana's Oil Heritage, Tuesday, October 23rd at 6 at Octavia Books. This month, the book club at the Ogden Museum of Southern Art discusses Louisiana women, their lives and times, Tuesday, October 23rd at 6 at the Ogden Museum of Southern Art. To join, register with Ellen Balkin, Education Coordinator, at ebalkin, B-A-L-K-I-N, at ogdenmuseum.org, or call 504-539-9608. Claire Keegan, the Irish Times Award-winning writer, reads Tuesday, October 23rd at 7 p.m. at Loyola's Dana Center. Coffee and Conversation, the annual series sponsored by the Tennessee Williams New Orleans Literary Festival and the East Bank Regional Library, begins with Moira Crone discussing The Not Yet, Wednesday, October 24th at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Humorist David Sedaris, author of Dress Your Family in Corduroy and Denim, Me Talk Pretty One Day, Naked, When You Are Engulfed in Flames, and Squirrel Meets Chipmunk, appears Wednesday, October 24th at 7:30 at McAllister Auditorium at Tulane University. His new book, Let's Explore Diabetes with Howls, won't be out until spring of 2013, but he'll be performing all new material and signing books after. For tickets, go to Ticketmaster.com. Poet Brad Richard reads from his new collection, Butcher Sugar, along with fiction writer Jamie Hatley, Wednesday, October 24th at 7 at the New Orleans Center for Creative Arts. Richard also reads Friday, October 26th at 6 p.m. at Maple Street Bookshop in Mid-City. Thomas Joseph Perez signs Katrina Lashes Arabia, Wednesday, October 24th from 6:30 to 8 at the New Orleans Healing Center location of Maple Street Bookshop. The Pirate's Alley Faulkner Society kicks off its A Lesson Before Dying Big Read, Wednesday, October 24th at 6:15 in Jackson Square. There'll be a mini concert by the music students of the Roots of Music, and then a session at the Louisiana State Museum. Today's guest, Arthur Anthony, discusses and signs Picturing Black New Orleans, a Creole photographer's view of the early 20th century, Thursday, October 25th at 5:30 at Garden District Bookshop, and Sunday, October 28th at 1 p.m. at Octavia Books. Novelist Robert Olin Butler signs his new mystery, The Hot Country, Thursday, October 25th at 6 at Octavia Books. Poet Chris Sullivan reads and signs his book, Mir Nola, as part of 17 Poets Literary and Performance Series, Thursday, October 25th at 8 at the Goldmine Saloon. Novelist George Singleton signs Stray Decorum, Friday, October 26th at 6 at Octavia Books. Don't miss the Louisiana Book Festival, Saturday from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. at the State Capitol, the State Library, and the State Museum in Baton Rouge. It's all free. Hundreds of authors will be on hand to delight you with their stories. John Biganay will receive the Louisiana Writer Award this year. If you're interested in volunteering or would like more information about the festival, visit louisianabookfestival.org. Marcel Bienvenu signs True Blood, Eats, Drinks, and Bites from Bon Ton, Sunday, October 28th at 2 p.m. at Garden District Bookshop. David Lummis reads from the Coffee Shop Chronicles of New Orleans 2, The Last Beaucour, at 2 p.m. Saturday, October 27th at Crescent City Books. Michael Alenzell reads from Errata, Sunday, October 28th at 3 p.m. at the Maple Leaf Bar. New York Times best-selling novelist Karen Marie Moning will launch her new book, Iced, at a spectacular pre-Halloween book launch party at Le Pavillon Hotel. The signing begins at 4 p.m. Monday, October 29th, and will continue through the evening. To attend, you must purchase the books at Octavia Books. For more information, check out octaviabooks.com. Beau Boudreau signs Running Red, Running Redder, and Ted Ross signs Am I a Jew, Monday, October 29th at 6 p.m. at Maple Street Bookshop on Maple Street. And Poppy Tooker signs her updated edition of Madame Begay's Recipes of Old New Orleans Creole Cookery, Tuesday, October 30th at 6 p.m. at Octavia Books. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening and keep reading.